What's making this group of middle-aged women laugh hysterically? Menopause, apparently.
I haven't experienced any memory loss. Who's that? You know,
oh my God, I gotta talk to you about my sex life. What about my hot flashes?
I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
When I got here, I felt calm, and I feel relaxed.
Basically, what most of my act is a parody of a scientific seminar.
It was just everywhere, and I realized looking at it that I was outmatched.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
The two-dimensional plane is the dance floor,
it's essentially
and the particles are the dance
floor. Kind of charcoal disintegration.
Use hereditary
electrons. You wouldn't know it's a well.
My mom said,
call 911.
I would say that they're ginormous questions.
On today's show, getting better info on the impact of fracking, combating the spread of Ebola, and chasing down a forgotten ancient skeleton. But first, back to that group of women laughing about hot flashes. Jokes aside, they were attending a talk about menopause to figure out how to deal with symptoms caused by diminishing hormone production in their bodies.
I hear all kinds of information, and then I hear the exact opposite of what I just heard. For example, hormones, and then I hear we shouldn't take hormones.
Hormone replacement, pills, patches, or creams that balance out the dwindling natural supply in women's bodies, has gone from magic bullet to devil incarnate to a very careful middle ground over the past 15 years.
Okay, Mrs. Allroyd, so you're here for your first visit today.
Yes.
Are you having any problems?
I haven't been really sleeping that well lately.
Yeah.
Just not feeling like myself.
Dr. Jane Porcelain is talking with a 49-year-old patient at Women for Women. That's at Lankenau Hospital in Wynwood, outside of Philadelphia. The patient complains about hot flashes and feeling irritable and cranky.
I am a little moodier now than I used to be, but I just kind of chalked it up to I have teenagers, so they're aggravating me, but I think I am a little moodier with them. I'm trying not to be, but I just can't stop it sometimes.
Eventually, Porcelain and her patient get to potential hormone therapy, weighing the risks and benefits.
And there are certainly benefits, but we encourage women to stay on the lowest dose possible for the shortest period of time.
And this kind of conversation did not really happen before 2002 because up to that point, hormone therapy was seen absolutely as the way to go for women struggling during menopause. But then,
women were terrified.
People whipped off their patches, they stopped taking their pills, and a lot of people were miserable.
The phones were ringing off the hook because women were really panicked.
What caused this widespread panic? Here's what happened in a nutshell. Generally, women are less at risk for cardiovascular disease than men until they go through menopause. Then the numbers even out. So health experts thought that it was hormones that protected women from getting heart disease. During menopause, hormone production of estrogen and progesterone decreases.
So they thought, well, let's see whether if we give all women hormone therapy, if we can decrease the risk of cardiovascular disease.
That's Neil Epperson. She directs the Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness. She says the Women's Health Initiative, a massive federal project, started in the early 90s and enrolled over 100,000 postmenopausal women to test what they were hoping were beneficial effects of hormone therapy. But
unfortunately, the data didn't pan out that way exactly.
Women should not start or continue this therapy to prevent heart disease. The findings show it doesn't work.
Women's Health Initiative Director Jacques Rousseau doling out some bad news at a Washington press conference in July of 2002.
In fact, the therapy increases the risk for a heart attack or stroke. Additionally, it increases the risk for breast cancer and for blood clots.
Women who take a popular hormone replacement drug after
risk
menopause not only increase their chances of getting breast cancer.
The media kind of hyped up, I think, excessively the risk of estrogen and made it sound like no woman who is postmenopausal should be on estrogen.
Increased risk of heart disease,
but now new research suggests
raise the risk of breast cancer.
But what layperson and a lot of physicians, unfortunately, still don't really recognize is that two-thirds of that sample were above 65 when they were enrolled in the study. That is way quite a number of years post-menopause and the last time these women would have had estrogen and been exposed to estrogen. And the one thing that we know is that if you go through a period of time with your body not exposed to these hormones, that when you add back these hormones years later, you don't get the exact same kind of response.
Epperson says the latest research shows that the risk-benefit analysis of hormone replacement is far more complicated and layered than the Women's Health Initiative findings suggested. Despite that, hormone use has declined significantly in the years since this study. Women remain scared to try it. Doctors are often reluctant to prescribe it. For many women, it's meant struggling with a variety of symptoms like mood swings, depression, hot flashes, or memory loss on their own.
Okay. So I'm going to close this behind me.
Alexandra Stoll owns Chimeo Gallery in Perkasie, Bucks County. She is 56 years old and started feeling menopause symptoms in her early 50s. She says her memory has taken a hit.
Oh, do you remember that movie where that woman who's married to that guy, you know, and one after another would be a domino of forgetting?
Do you joke about it with your friends?
All the time. Constantly. That's about all we ever do talk about. I haven't experienced any memory loss. Who's that? You know, the humor is definitely there.
Stoll is experiencing a variety of symptoms, but she's not using hormone therapy because she says she generally tries to cope with ailments in a natural way.
Mostly it was, I wrote down, arthritis starting to happen in my hands, so that was new, you know, and I think that was menopausally related. And trouble, a little more trouble focusing than I had had.
Stoll says she's wondered if her cognitive symptoms really come from menopause.
You know, you question all these things. Is it menopause or is just I'm not as interested as I used to be in whatever it is? You know, I mean, you do change.
Neil Epperson says it's easy to blame changes in memory and cognition on age, but recent research that followed women over a long period of time found that there is an age-unrelated impact of menopause on brain function. And for many women, that comes at a highly inconvenient time.
Obviously, when a woman starts to get to her 50s, if she's done well professionally, then she's probably at the top of her game. And they really rely on their noggin to be able to do their job.
Many women report mood swings during menopause, feeling irritable. But there's also an increased risk for depression.
There are women for whom they've never had a depressive episode in their entire life, and they're still 2 to 3 times more likely to become depressed in the menopause transition. It is as if having these hormonal fluctuations in this manner and at this age has unmasked their vulnerability to depression.
Despite the serious symptoms many women experience, Epperson says some feel their doctors are not really listening and tell them to just get through this.
I can't tell you how many people come to my office and say, my doctor will not prescribe hormone therapy. And this is a woman who is really suffering, and she has no contraindication. She has no increased risk of breast cancer in her family. She has no blood clotting disorders. She doesn't have a lot of strokes in her family.
Best practice today in terms of treating menopause symptoms means a very individualized approach, says Neil Epperson.
If you're going to do it, the best thing to do is to work with your physician to find a strategy that works best for you and to do it early on, perhaps even before you've gone a full year without your last menstrual period.
Epperson gives talks to OBGYNs on hormone replacement and the latest research and findings, and she says the field is adapting and changing with new approaches emerging. For example, cyclical hormone replacement that would mimic more closely how the body disperses hormones into its operating system. On the issue of menopause, along with some suggestions on how lifestyle changes fit in, on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. All of Philadelphia's major birthing hospitals have stopped giving out discharge bags filled with formula to new moms. This is something a lot of hospitals across the country are doing. And as The Pulse's Alana Gordon reports, the recent announcement here in Philadelphia is part of a broader push to encourage breastfeeding.
When Bree Ferrar gave birth to her daughter Mackenzie 2 months ago at Hahnemann Hospital, she was expecting to leave with a tote bag containing formula and coupons. But that didn't happen.
I thought it was really weird.
Ferrar is headed back into Hahnemann for a checkup. She says she doesn't use formula, but even so, was disappointed leaving empty-handed.
It's nice, you know, to get the little gift bag. Some people are less fortunate, and I think some people really need them.
Formula companies supply hospitals with their branded bags. Inside Hahnemann, Dr. Dan Guilfoyle, Director of Labor and Delivery, says they've been giving them out to new moms as they leave for as long as he can remember. That changed in April, just before Ferrar gave birth, when Hahnemann joined the city's five other major hospitals responsible for nearly 20,000 births annually and no longer giving them out. Guilfoyle admits he was worried moms like Ferrar would be really upset. But he says that hasn't happened.
I think that we made the assumption that people were more attached to the bags than they actually are.
Guilfoyle says the long-term benefits of not giving out the bags far outweighs what moms might perceive as the short-term perks. Formula is also still available at the hospital for free to moms who need or want it. But public health advocates, including those with the American Academy of Pediatrics and the World Health Organization, tout the health benefits of breastfeeding, both for the mom and infant, including fewer ear infections and decreased risk of diabetes. Giving out manufacturer bags with formula in it, they say, sends a mixed message. Pennsylvania hospitals stopped distributing them several years ago. Since then, area hospitals have been meeting and all decided to follow suit. Dr. Gail Heron is director of Temple's postpartum unit and says the hospital stopped giving out the bags in January.
We anticipated that patients would be very disappointed in not receiving the bags, and there was often discussion over the years about if we get rid of the bag, then the patients will go to other hospitals to get the bag. So the fact that all the hospitals together got rid of the bag makes it so that there's no competition. We're all in this together.
The trade group, the International Formula Council, states the new policies detract from the real problems new moms face, like access to health care. Heron, with Temple, says additional pressure to encourage breastfeeding is coming down from the main hospital accreditation agency, the Joint Commission. In January, it started requiring hospitals to collect their exclusive breastfeeding rates. Temple's rates are around 15%. She says breastfeeding becomes a lot harder if a mom uses formula early on. And even if she intends to breastfeed, she's less likely to do so if given a bag with formula when leaving the hospital.
Giving bottles here and there because you're having a perceived low supply or a problem may lead to problems with breastfeeding down the line. If you give the baby the formula bottle, then the baby's not incentivized to continue to suck and to help the mom make more milk. What a mother needs to really do is just breastfeed very frequently in order to keep her milk supply up.
Heron says breastfeeding is just hard at first. A baby may not take that much milk, and a mom may experience difficulty lactating. Down the road, that can be compounded by socioeconomic factors, work schedules, and ability to pump. But that's why she and others say the new bag policy is just one part of a much broader effort by hospitals to set moms up for success with breastfeeding. Back at Hahnemann, Guilfoyle says the hospital has undergone a whole sea change in breastfeeding culture, thanks to support from other hospitals and pediatricians. Nurses and other health staff now go through an intensive training on how to approach the topic in a positive way with expecting and new moms.
Before, I think we used to ask people, do you want to breastfeed or bottle feed, as if they were equivalent things. And now we ask people, are you going to breastfeed? And that change in attitude just gives a different signal to patients that one is preferable to the other.
Nurse educator Deborah Davis points to another recent change that's increased the number of new moms choosing to breastfeed. The hospital now offers skin-to-skin time between the mother and baby immediately after birth, instead of whisking the newborn away to be weighed and bathed.
How many laboring mothers who've just delivered their baby end up breastfeeding because the skin-to-skin, the baby does a natural crawl to the breast. And it's been documented, it's been researched, that the baby will literally find the breast on his own. So we've had many mothers who are like, wow, this is great. I want to do this.
Just a few weeks ago, the hospital kickstarted efforts to keep the mom and infant together at all times. Such actions, Davis and others say, encourage mother-child bonding and breastfeeding before a family leaves the hospital, with or without a tote bag. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up on The Pulse, a system that's providing public information on fracking, but getting to the data is tough.
The first thing we noticed, there was new data coming in, and then we dug a little bit deeper, and there was a little error message that was coming out that said, hey, you're sending too many requests, you're being blocked for 24 hours. And then they block you for 48 hours, and then they block you forever.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. 6 years into the shale boom, transparency about the chemicals used in fracking remains elusive. A website called Frack Focus is supposed to be a national clearinghouse for that data, but some groups are raising serious questions about how Frack Focus puts that information out to the public, one well at a time. State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports.
This is a story about a place where big drilling meets big data. A website called Frack Focus. The site is run by an industry-supported nonprofit called the Groundwater Protection Council, a group of state regulators who oversee water quality and oil and gas development. A few years back, the group wanted to help the industry, give the public answers to a burning question about the shale gas boom.
What the heck's going down these wells?
In 2011, with funding from industry groups, Frack Focus was born. Drillers could voluntarily upload lists of the chemicals used to frack wells to release natural gas. The following year, Pennsylvania began requiring operators to use the website as part of the state's new chemical disclosure law. It's one of 14 states that have delegated their public disclosure systems to Frack Focus. Now, a farmer in, say, Washington County could log on to frackfocus.org, search for a well near her cow pasture, and pull up a PDF document from the company with a list of what went downhole. But some big data geeks say that's a problem.
My name is Paul Woods, and I'm the big data wrangler at SkyTruth.
SkyTruth is a nonprofit that uses publicly available data and satellite images to monitor the impacts of the industry on the environment, all from a tiny office in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. So when the SkyTruth team learned about Frack Focus, Woods says they were psyched.
We thought, hey, this would be great. All the data's there.
But it turns out it wasn't so easy to get. Here's the problem. Drillers post their lists of chemicals as individual PDF documents for each well they frack. Computers can't understand the documents, so it's harder to tell a computer to pull the data out and organize the information as a table or a spreadsheet. At the time, Frack Focus had records for more than 30,000 wells. To mine all that data, SkyTruth would have had to open one PDF at a time and then copy and paste all the information about each ingredient into a spreadsheet. Woods colleague David Manthos says it was a daunting task.
We calculated it about 6 years worth of labor, and just at minimum wage would have been something on the order of $90,000 just to manually do this whole thing.
So Woods designed a bot a software program that could do all the work for them. Every night, the bots scraped the site for all the available PDFs and compiled the information into a searchable database. And with FrackFocus's permission, SkyTruth published that database in 2012. It turns out they weren't the only ones interested in this information.
We were overwhelmed by the response of people contacting us, asking questions about the data set, downloading it, and then the subsequent reports and publications that use that data set to say very interesting things.
For instance, researchers at the Argonne National Laboratory near Chicago used the data to look at how much water goes into producing natural gas. Even a consulting firm that does data analysis for the industry tapped into SkyTruth's database. But one night last June, the bot hit a roadblock.
The first thing we noticed, there was no new data coming in. And then when we went to look and find out what was going on, we started testing it. And then we dug a little bit deeper, and there was a little error message that was coming out that said, hey, you're sending too many requests. You're being blocked for 24 hours. And then they block you for 48 hours, and then they block you forever.
The Groundwater Protection Council, the nonprofit that runs FrackFocus, had set up a system to block automated programs like SkyTruth's bot. The council says it was to prevent bots from slowing down traffic to the site. Remember the farmer with the cow pasture living near a gas well? The Groundwater Protection Council says that's who FrackFocus was meant for, not groups like SkyTruth looking for big data on drilling. The council wouldn't agree to a recorded interview, but we spoke with Associate Director Dan Yates, who explained that to get companies to voluntarily disclose what's in their fracking fluid, the council had to agree it would only serve up the data one well at a time. The industry didn't want it to be a wholesale repository of data on fracking. Yates admits that's up for reconsideration, in part because 14 states have required drillers to use the website.
Like it or not, FrackFocus is now one of the most comprehensive, if not the most comprehensive, source of information about the chemicals being used in unconventional oil and gas development.
Kate Konchnick is director of the Environmental Policy Initiative at Harvard Law School. Konchnick gives FrackFocus a failing grade as a disclosure tool. She found that the data were often inaccurate, and that companies were making trade secret claims for chemicals at one well site while fully disclosing the same chemicals at another.
Not maybe as robust a tool as one would hope if something is regulated or required by state law.
FrackFocus has come under new scrutiny as the Obama administration considers whether to use it as a disclosure tool for fracking on public lands. And in March, a Department of Energy task force recommended that the site's administrators beef up quality control and allow the public better access to all the data. The group even recommended funding for these improvements. Konchnick says the Groundwater Protection Council is under more pressure to make changes.
I think there are a number of interests being represented by FrackFocus, and I think those who manage the database are having to juggle a lot of those interests.
The council says it's open to change and is already working on fixing some of the site's limitations. So whatever became of SkyTruth's efforts to get the data? It's been just over a year since the bot was blocked from the site. Paul Woods says,
We're stalled.
In the spring, SkyTruth teamed up with another environmental nonprofit called Frack Tracker, based in Pittsburgh, to try to work things out with the site's administrators. So far, no deal. Today, FrackFocus has records from more than 70,000 wells. It's still a unique source of information about a technology that's changing communities and the global energy economy. But data miners are frustrated that the big information inside FrackFocus has been purposefully made so small. Samantha Malone from Frack Tracker puts it this way.
Imagine trying to understand your financial spending throughout the year by taking photos of all of your receipts of anything you ever purchased the entire year. You would need to look at each one at a time, and even then you still couldn't see the big picture because you couldn't possibly remember what you read in the first photo of your receipt.
Without big data, Woods from SkyTruth says, even individual homeowners can't see the big picture of how the shale boom is impacting them or their communities.
The kind of people who are going to answer those questions for you are people like us. And if we can't get the data because they only want to give it to individual homeowners about their individual wells, then they haven't really accomplished public disclosure.
For The Pulse, I'm Katie Culinary.
No water in the water fountain. No sign on the sidewalk.
If you say, oh my hair, what you doing there? Nothing much to do when you're going nowhere. Woo-ha, woo-ha, gotcha.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. A 2012 train crash in Paulsboro, New Jersey, resulted in a chemical spill and a cloud of toxic gas that sent 28 people to the hospital. Last week, investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board pointed to a string of mistakes following the derailment.
I think the emergency response for this derailment was, in one word, abysmal. The citizens of communities expect and they count on that when there's a disaster in their community, that the emergency response system is going to protect them. And that didn't happen in this case.
Tanya English spoke with a Mantua Township resident who ended up in the emergency room twice on that Friday, November 30th.
There was nothing. It was a normal morning to me. I got my morning coffee. A little something to eat.
Ronald Morris is a carpenter. He was meeting his father in Paulsboro to fix a client's door. At about the same time, the first 911 calls were coming in.
Hurry up! Look at it!
911, where is the emergency?
Hurry up, the train derailed at the train bridge in Paulsboro.
Okay.
It fell in the water. Hurry up, smoke's everywhere.
Is anyone injured?
Morris says around 7:30, his truck hit a fog.
I mean, I was rolling very slow. I could barely see in front of me. I rolled down my window and smelled outside. It smelled weird to me. It didn't smell like smoke. It actually, like, I could just about taste it.
Meanwhile, more calls to police.
Hello?
Yeah, what's wrong?
Yeah, a train. It's spewing out all kind of gas. It derailed into the Mantua Creek.
Okay. Four Conrail tanker cars toppled that morning and released a toxic gas of the chemical vinyl chloride. Morris was a quarter mile away and says the cloud engulfed his truck.
At that point, it felt like it started irritating me to where it was like kind of like burning my skin. Like it just felt like it was on me.
Morris talked about that day from his attorney's office in Cherry Hill. Lawyer Mark Cooker wants Conrail to pay for his client's future medical expenses.
They'll pay for certain emergency room bills, but they're not going to pay for ongoing care. They're not going to pay for cancer screening or ongoing checkups.
Cooker says that morning on November 30th, Conrail failed to quickly reveal the health risks of vinyl chloride.
Well, if you can smell it, it means it's present at a level of 3,000 parts per million. That's what's called the odor threshold for vinyl chloride. If you can taste it, it's got to be even more than that. And Ron's not the only person who said he could taste it.
I was coughing up, like phlegm and stuff like that. I started getting dizzy. I was feeling nauseous.
So sick, Morris says, that when he arrived at work, his father rushed him to the emergency room. At Underwood Memorial Hospital, Morris went straight to a decontamination room. Doctors gave him a breathing treatment, hooked him to an IV, and monitored his blood pressure for several hours before he was discharged. But later on, back at home, Morris was sick again.
I mean, I was down on the floor. I was actually coughing up blood and stuff. I was just like a sack of potatoes on the, you know, hugging the white porcelain, they say, you know.
That's why I called 911, because I could not get him off the floor, and he was in and out.
Morris's wife, Kristen Paquel, says her family got through that day, but she's been worried ever since.
He was in bed all day Monday. And that's not him. Look at him. He's got muscle. He's a goer, you know. He's a worker. He's not the same person at all.
This happens, like, good twice a day where I don't feel like I have enough air in my lungs where I got to take, like, I go, you know, I don't know. Is this going to give me cancer? I got young kids. It's just scary.
Well, certainly vinyl chloride is bad stuff. Vinyl chloride is a known human carcinogen.
Toxicologist Richard Parent leads Consultox Limited. He's not involved in the Conrail case, but often works as an expert witness when disputes over chemicals go to court. He says vinyl chloride has been linked to a rare type of liver cancer, but only for people who work with high levels of the chemical on a daily basis over many years. In Paulsboro, some people are wondering, what are the long-term health problems for someone who breathes vinyl chloride for just a few minutes?
The data is just not available to assess risk that one has for developing any disease.
The New Jersey Department of Health surveyed local residents in the days following the Conrail accident. and many people reported eye irritation, trouble breathing, and dizziness.
A lot of times those symptoms can develop as a result of just a person being concerned and sort of developing the symptoms because somebody told them that that's the kind of symptoms they should be developing. I don't know, because it gets into a psychological thing.
Attorney Mark Cooker says Ronald Morris and hundreds of his other clients are in limbo. But he says the results of the health department survey are a first step and validation.
You're not nuts. It's not in your mind. This was enough to make a lot of people sick, in spite of what you might have been told at the time or afterwards.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Tanya contacted the Consolidated Rail Corporation, Conrail. Spokesman Michael Hotra said Conrail cannot comment on the claims of anyone who is suing the company. Hotra said, quote, "We will address the claims of litigants through our responsive legal filings and in court." You're listening to The Pulse here on WHYY. The Ebola outbreak in West Africa has claimed over 900 lives, and many fear that the deadly disease is spreading out of control. Could an Ebola vaccine impact this crisis? Joining us now is Hildegund Ertl. She's the director of the Wistar Institute Vaccine Center. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me here.
What is the status of a potential Ebola vaccine?
So there are many Ebola vaccines that are in preclinical testing, which means in testing in experimental animals. Two of those vaccines have been in clinical testing. Obviously, now with this crisis on the horizon, a number of additional vaccines are fairly rapidly advancing towards phase one trials. The two that have been tested, and I actually don't have the impression that they're planning on using them, have undergone a phase one trial. So once you're ready to do a trial, you actually have three trials. The phase one trial is a safety trial. You use escalating doses of the vaccine to determine a safe and immunogenic dose. So you not only determine safety, but also you test for immune responses. The phase two trial is you use the dose that looks the most promising and go into a somewhat larger cohort of people, and there you study immune responses. And then the phase three trial is a real hard one. It's an efficacy trial where you basically go into at-risk people and vaccinate them. And if you have a virus that's not that bad, like influenza virus, you can actually challenge them and show the vaccine works. If you have a virus like rabies or HIV or Ebola, you cannot challenge people. So you basically either have to use at-risk patients, and you have to use a lot, and compare them to a placebo-vaccinated cohort to see a statistically significant difference in infection rates. And depending on the incidence, that can take 10,000 people right there.
So whatever is happening right now likely will not impact the crisis that we're seeing
So VRC, the Vaccine Research Center at the NIH, is talking about starting the next trial in September. That will be a phase one trial. And before that has gone through phase two and three, at least 2 years will pass. So no, if we take the usual track, this will not impact the current outbreak.
Is there any way to speed up that process and still be safe?
Yeah. So one way is fast tracking. You could take such a drug and basically allow its use in very high in a high risk patients. If you think that this will save lives, that's permitted. That would be one way, and that could happen fairly rapidly. The other possibility is in 2002, after 9/11. I think there was so much concern about bioterror attacks that Congress basically established an act that allows for the use of fairly untested drugs in emergency situations. I don't think the situation with Ebola warrants that, but that would be another possibility.
How come we don't have a vaccine for Ebola already? Is it an especially difficult virus, or
I don't think it's a particularly difficult virus. I think it's a question of there aren't enough cases. In order for biopharma to actually make a vaccine, they need to have the guarantee that their product will be sold and that they, in the end, sell enough to offset the cost of development. Ebola comes around every 3 to 4 years. Sometimes we have 50 cases. This time we have over 1,000. But it's sporadic, and the numbers are low. So it's simply not worthwhile for pharma to develop a vaccine. For making a vaccine costs millions and millions of dollars.
And the countries where Ebola is predominant don't have the kinds of institutions we have.
Well, it would be cheaper if you would make the vaccines in these countries. But as you said, they don't have vaccine manufacturer in capacity. They're trying to develop it, but it's not there yet.
Do you think this scare will put some fire behind the search for a vaccine?
I mean, I think it will put fire in the American and European scientists to work harder on getting an Ebola vaccine. Will it help us to provide Africa with an infrastructure that's really needed to make vaccines? I doubt it.
Can you compare the importance of finding a vaccine for this virus to other viruses, perhaps things that you've worked on?
I mean, okay, let's say rabies. That's one virus I work on. Rabies is a neglected disease at this point. We have a vaccine that works very nicely, but it's prohibitively expensive. So it's underused in developing countries. And we know that, for example, in India, at least 35,000 people die each year of rabies. So that's a little bit more than, you know, the 800 that have died this year of Ebola virus. In China, I heard yesterday when I met with a bunch of Chinese, 40 million humans get post-exposure vaccination to rabies each year. So 40 million people is a lot of people. So in that sense, Ebola is still a fairly small problem. The question is, how is this outbreak going to develop? If this turns out to spin into a major epidemic, obviously something has to be done.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here.
Hildegund Ertl is the director of the Wistar Institute Vaccine Center. Up on the pulse, are allergy symptoms getting worse each year?
We're seeing patients earlier, and more patients, the volume seems to be increasing. And some who are moderate or mild in years past are now more severe.
Is climate change to blame? That's next on the pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. If even hearing the word ragweed makes your eyes water, you might be one of nearly 45 million Americans with seasonal allergies. And allergists say the number of people with sensitivities to ragweed and other plants is growing. Reporter Julie Grant examines whether climate change is fueling the rise in allergies and asthma.
Jenny Fisher has been taking over-the-counter medication for allergies for a long time. Without it, she suffers cold-like symptoms, a runny nose, sneezing, and congestion. An allergy pill usually made it better, But a couple of years ago, things started to get worse.
I'd be out at 5:30 in the morning walking my dog, and it would just be huffing and puffing, and, you know, I couldn't catch my breath. It's scary.
Her doctor, David Schoner, diagnosed her with asthma. Like many allergists, he's seeing more patients with allergies, and those allergies are getting more severe. Schoner spends his lunch hour filling out new prescriptions.
The number of patients calling in for appointments for allergies has just skyrocketed.
The American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology says a top reason for that is climate change. Higher temperatures and carbon dioxide levels are affecting plants, and that's leading to more allergies. Immunologist Asha Patel walks up to the roof of Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh every morning to take pollen counts. She uses a machine called a spore trap. It looks kind of like a small weather vane, and Patel says it pulls in air like a large nose.
It's like there's a suction created. So it draws the air through this opening right here, and the sample is collected inside.
Patel takes a glass microscope slide out of the spore trap. It's the one she put in yesterday, and it's covered with speckles. She takes it down to the lab and dots on pink dye. Under the microscope, she watches as a perfect circle emerges. She says it's the pollen from a common weed.
Here's the English plantain. It's one of the weed.
Researchers do this kind of pollen collection all over the country, and they've seen trends emerge. Dr. Leonard Bielery of Rutgers University has been studying the connection between pollen levels and the throng showing up at his office.
I saw a hidden signal in the pollen count changing over time. And as such, then I started correlating that we're seeing patients earlier and more patients. The volume seems to be increasing. And some who are moderate or mild in years past are now more severe.
In a study published by the National Academy of Sciences, Bielery and other researchers looked at a common allergen, ragweed, in the Midwest and Canada. In Canada, they found the ragweed season was almost a month longer in 2009 than in 1995. Bielery says the ragweed season in our region is about 5 days longer than it was 20 years ago. Researchers looking at the impacts of climate change also find that as carbon dioxide levels rise, the pollen is becoming more severe. Louis Ziska is a researcher with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Just changing the CO2 from the early part of the 20th century to the latter part of the 20th century, for example, doubles the production of pollen from a single plant. And there was some indication that it was also more allergenic pollen, that is, it was producing more of the proteins that people are allergic to.
Researcher Leonard Bielery says the worsening pollen is especially dangerous for children who already have respiratory problems.
And you will cause an inflammatory mix, what I call the witch's brew, where we have the temperature, ozone, and pollen all mixed together. You will cause an incredible inflammatory response of the eyes, nose, and therefore, in those who are more prone to it, the lungs as well, leading to more asthma.
Bielery says on high pollen days, people with respiratory problems can take over-the-counter medicine preventatively, so itchy eyes and runny noses don't turn into dangerous asthma. For The Pulse, I'm Julie Grant.
Julie Grant is a reporter for the Allegheny Front, one of our partner organizations. Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. Have you ever wondered why some people seem to deal with stress so much better than others? A recent study could provide some clues. Joining us now to explain is our regular Pulse contributor, Dr. Bethany Brookshire, also known as PsyCurious. She's a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Bethany, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Bethany, what are we learning about who is susceptible to stress and why?
Well, to start, we are all susceptible to stress. Most everybody responds to a stressful situation. Some people kind of eat their feelings. Some people maybe drink a little more. Some people don't sleep so well. You know, everyone responds to stress, but the difference is how people respond to stress long term. Some people, after a strong life stress, can just kind of shrug it off, go about their daily lives. Other people, after a strong life stress, it triggers major depressive disorder and can result in really long-term consequences. And so a lot of people have been asking, what is the difference between those people? What's the difference in their brains between someone who can recover from a stress and move on versus someone who develops a major depressive episode?
And what did they find?
Well, so this study was in mice, and they looked at mice exposed to a short-term stress. And they found that in response to short-term stress called learned helplessness, the mice that were resilient to the stress, that recovered and acted just fine, actually had fewer neuronal connections in the prefrontal cortex of the brain than mice that were susceptible to the stress. So mice that responded to stressful situations with depressive-like behaviors actually showed more neuronal connections in the prefrontal cortex than those that were resilient to the stress.
Does that mean more stressful messages are getting through when you have more of those connections, or how could we picture this?
That's one hypothesis, certainly. It's a correlation, so it's kind of difficult to say whether the connections themselves are the depressive response or not. But what's interesting is that the increases in neuronal connections, in the connections between brain cells in the prefrontal cortex, are in an area in mice that is similar to an area in humans called Brodmann's Area 25. And this area has been the target of a lot of research from a scientist named Helen Mayberg. She's been utilizing deep brain stimulation in people with severe intractable depression in Brodmann's Area 25. And many of those patients have very positive responses following stimulation in that area. So the changes that the scientists in this study saw with neuronal connections in that area might relate to some of the changes occurring in the human brains that Helen Mayberg has been studying.
How did the researchers stress out the mice to test this?
So the technique is called learned helplessness. And you put a mouse in a small cage for about an hour. And during that time, the mouse is exposed to electrical shocks to their feet. The shocks are pretty mild. There's no damage, but they are kind of nasty and unpleasant. And so then following the exposure to the shocks, the mouse is given the opportunity to escape. So he sees a light and a door opens and he can get out of there if he wants to. And so mice that respond with resilience to this learned helplessness paradigm see the light and run straight for the door. They know to get out. And if they run fast enough, they will never get shocked again. Mice that are susceptible and display learned helplessness kind of hunker down and take it. They don't attempt to run for the door. They don't attempt to escape. They don't act in an adaptive way as a normal mouse, in theory, should act in this situation.
So this research could really be very important research in helping us understand the detrimental effects of stress.
That's the goal, yeah. So to understand what makes a brain respond with depression to stress versus what makes one just shrug it off and move on. And, you know, right now we have a correlation between neuron connections in this area of the brain and a stress response. And that can help us find out what is the underlying difference. What is making those neurons connect more? And understanding that could give us new drug targets and new brain areas to look at when finding treatments for major depression.
Thank you, Bethany.
Thank you.
That's regular Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She also writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab. You're listening to The Pulse here on WHYY. We got word this week that the Penn Museum discovered a 6,500-year-old skeleton in its basement, which begged the obvious question, how did they lose it in the first place? And what are they going to do with it now that they found it? We sent Carolyn Beeler to the museum in West Philadelphia to check it out.
The Penn Museum didn't exactly lose the skeleton. For decades, associate curator Janet Monge knew it was in her storage room, packed in a wooden crate underneath a box of femurs and a giant bear skull.
Periodically, I made that mental note, you know, we need to figure out what's going on with this specimen.
The skeleton is laid out on its back, and it's covered in a congealed mass of wax and dirt. Its identification documents, noting the skeleton's age and where it was found, were missing. That is until this spring, when a museum colleague digitizing old documents mentioned records he'd found for a mysterious missing skeleton.
I almost immediately, based on his description and then looking at the photos, identified it as this person, this unidentified person.
This person was male, 50s-ish, standing between 5'8" and 5'10". He was unearthed by Sir Leonard Woolley around 1930 in present-day Iraq. Monge and colleague William Hafford used photos of Woolley from the famous dig to match the skeleton to its records.
You can see him heating wax in the photos, and he's dribbling it across, helping to infuse the dirt around the bones to hold them in place. And then he cuts underneath and slides a board in so he can pull the whole body out rather than just trying to collect bones, because they weren't in very good condition still. They were kind of crumbly.
Bad timing contributed to the skeleton being separated from its identifying papers for 85 years.
It came in during the Great Depression, and we did not have many people working. That's part of the problem.
Another part? The dizzying number of artifacts the archaeologist Woolley brought back. Monge says they can't remove the wax that covers the bones to run some typical tests, but they can CT scan the skeleton to create a 3D model.
So rather than actually sort of physically trying to take it out of this conglomerate mass, basically, we'll virtually extract the individual pieces and put it back together.
Even basic pelvic bone analysis to determine gender is more advanced than the techniques Woolley would have used back in the 1930s.
You would tend to say if they were buried with weapons, they were male, and if they were buried with jewelry, they were female. And this is not absolutely true at all.
Hafford says reuniting the skeleton with its papers feels like giving him his history back. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Leanne Tiffany is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at our website at whyy.org/thepulse or on iTunes. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your questions, your feedback, your story ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.